We're forced to be here tonight, and I hope that you all feel well. I hope you can hear the microphone. This is a request that you get the microphone a little bit farther back to hear in the back, so hopefully you can hear. I've enjoyed the song service and the prayer. Glad to see everyone here. Tonight, our lesson is going to be a little different lesson than what you might expect. The one that you probably expect out of me is the one for tomorrow night. This one's a little bit different. Going to be a little bit different approach to it. The last two nights, I was very passionate in my delivery because I felt passionately about what I presented to you, about love and forgiveness. This one tonight, I'm going to back off just a little bit because I need to be very, very logical, and you need to be very, very logical as you listen to what I say. And remember what I say. And if I say something that sounds a little bit strange, I just want you to remember it and to think about it. Because I'm not expecting you to accept at face value anything I give you tonight. But I want you to think about it and tuck it away and see how it fits situations that you've heard of, that you may be in the future, and use it to build what you think marriage is supposed to be. We're talking about marriage by the letter. We also talked about cause and effect. We had that seed coming up last night. I planted that seed. We're talking about cause and effect. Marriage by the letter is more about the effect than the cause. Romans 7 and 6 is where our text came from for the lesson tonight and tomorrow night. Paul said, "But now we're delivered from the law, that being dead wherein we were held, that we should serve in newness of spirit and not in the oldness of the letter." And what we're going to talk about tonight is what I consider the oldest of the letter, which is Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9, the exception clause for fornication. Marriage by the Spirit is what I think the new law of marriage is that Jesus intended us to live by. Cause and effect. Under the old law of the letter of marriage, If the effect was fornication, cut it off. But if the under the new law, the law of the Spirit, I believe Jesus is teaching us to look at the cause more than the effect. The effect is the unchastity, the unfaithfulness. That's the effect. But what caused it? What caused it? I don't believe that Jesus had us just to look at the effect of it without us looking at the cause of it. So marriage by the Spirit is tomorrow night. Marriage by the letter tonight. Now, I want you to think that the lesson tonight and tomorrow night both go together. Please don't judge everything I tell you just by what you hear tonight. There's too much to try to cover in both nights. The one tomorrow night sort of wraps up what we're talking about tonight. So let's get on a little bit farther. Five general views of marriage to get started. First, we have one end of what I'd say is extreme view. No marriage. Celibacy. No marriage at all. Complete celibacy. And then we have married for life, which some people call death only. I don't particularly like the name death only because I'm an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. And death only to me is like somebody is trying to find a way out of something. And I'm not trying to find a way out of anything. I'm trying to find a way to stay in marriage and make it the best relationship we can have. So if I'm going to be called by a name, I'd much rather be called a married for life man than a death only man. And then we have those that believe you're married until fornication. That's sometimes called the exception position. Then we have those that say divorce and remarriage for any reason. Whatever reason. Okay. And then we have some that say you don't even have to marry at all. Just cohabitate. So I think we sort of see from these five things, maybe this pretty well covers the range that I can imagine of a man and a woman living together. Either no marriage because they want to be celibate, or married for life, married until fornication, divorced and remarried for any reason, and then just you don't have to get married at all. Just start living together. Why should we bother? Why should we even have a lesson on this? Because of the pain that's caused if people don't follow God's Word. Much pain can come because of this situation. It's painful. It is of great consequence to the spouses involved. Much pain to those involved. There's much pain to the children involved in breakups. And we're speaking of church-authorized breakups here. And the congregation involved. It affects also the congregation involved. Now, I want to show you a passage here in Revelation 2, 20-23. And this is a passage in the story that of Jesus' words to one of the seven churches. Notwithstanding, I have a few things against you. Notice that this is a letter to the church, to the congregation. Because you suffer that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication, and to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and I gave her space to repent of her fornication, and she repented not. Behold, I will cast her into a bed, and them that commit adultery with her into great tribulation, except they repent of their deeds. And I will kill her children with death. And all the churches shall know that I am he which searches the reins and hearts. And I will give unto every one of you according to your works. Now there are some that say the letters to the seven churches don't represent letters to seven churches, but they represent periods of time in the church. Okay? That may be true. But nevertheless, I believe that there was a situation involved in each one of those representative churches that we can imagine would have happened. Because there's not many times that there was some kind of a fantasy situation used to illustrate something in the Bible. And so if this does represent a certain period of time, it still represents something that could have happened. And so what we have is a woman teaching to commit fornication, to commit adultery, and it was considered sin even though this congregation accepted it and okayed it. And God said, those that have done this, I'm going to throw them into a bed and burn them up. I don't accept it. It's not my law. It's not my intention for this to happen. So, I use this verse to show that this is of great consequence to congregations. We must understand, before we get started, I'm going to try to lay some groundwork here that will apply to the points I'm going to give you tonight, and I can't give you all of them. I'm just going to give you a few, just to show you the line of thinking that goes between both ways. So first, let's talk about the rules of engagement when we think about this situation or others. There is a detailed view where you look closely at each word. And sometimes the word is translated from the Greek, and we will do that a little bit tonight. And if you remember the lesson we had Sunday night, when I told you Sunday night that what we were trying to do was to lay a groundwork for something we were going to study all this week. We were laying the groundwork, living by every word. I presented that to you Sunday night. That's part of the detailed view, where you look closely at the words themselves. And then there is the big picture view, where you back off from the individual words, and you say, okay, what did Jesus mean? What's the difference between living by the letter and living by the Spirit? The letter caused death. The Spirit caused life. The letter looked at the effect of what happened. The Spirit looks at the cause of what happened. What led to that effect? And I believe that living by the Spirit means we're looking at the cause, not just the effect. There are points in any type of difference of opinion in the church. There's going to be points for each side. One side will use this verse for a point. Another side will use that verse for a point. For each one of those points, there is a counterpoint. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I'm going to give you all the points that's just right, that there's not a counterpoint for it. Sure there is. There's a counterpoint for every position in the Bible. There is consistent logic, and there is tortured logic. Now, of course, I'm going to tell you that I'm going to present to you consistent logic. There are some of my brothers that would tell me, or would tell you, that Bill Francis is not giving you consistent logic. He's giving you tortured logic. They'll give you consistent logic. So you've got to judge yourself. Is the logic good or is the logic pushed just a little bit? I'll show you some examples of that in just a moment. Another thing we want to understand when we think about the things Jesus taught, and this is important to understand, one of the points that this question hangs on is what exactly was Jesus teaching? What could he teach? What did he teach? I'm not going to stand here and tell you that Jesus didn't teach anything that applied to us, because we use too much of what Jesus taught. But I'm going to tell you, this is my logic on what I think Jesus taught. I believe Jesus taught principles, practices, and prophecies. He taught principles which are good from the beginning of time until the end of time, such as, knock and it shall be opened unto you. Seek and you shall find. You shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free. Those are principles. They don't teach any specific practice. They teach a principle. And I believe that principle will apply to us as much as it would apply to the people in Jesus' time, as it would have applied in the days of Noah. Principles. Jesus taught about specific practices. We're going to read about a few of these practices in just a minute. And I think we have enough logic and common sense about us that we can tell when Jesus was speaking of a specific practice for that specific time. And then, of course, we know he gave us prophecies about things to happen in the future, which we know applies to our times. Okay, here's a view for the exception. Let's look at our two source texts for those that believe in the exception. Let's get on into the study after this groundwork. Source text, Matthew 5:32. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. Whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, commits adultery. And I put in parentheses because depending on which version you pick up, you may pick up a King James, New American, or some other different version of the Bible, you'll read this word put away is changed into divorce or whatever. But what I've tried to put up here is the Greek word, and I want you to notice in parentheses, it's the same word right there. And I might not pronounce it right. I believe that the pronunciation is apollyo, but it's the same word. Apollyo is the same word, whether it's translated divorced or whether it's translated put away. That's important because sometimes people get a version that just says divorced and they don't want to listen to when we say the word put away. Matthew 19:9, I say unto you, whosoever shall put away, again, apollyo, same word, put it in parentheses for you, his wife, except it be fornication, and shall marry another, commits adultery. Whosoever marries her, which is put away, same word, does commit adultery. So I want you to see, these are the two verses that it hangs on. Now let's talk a little bit about definitions. What does that word mean, apollyo? Okay, from one of the more accepted dictionaries that defines Greek words, apollyo means to free fully, that is literally to relieve, release, dismiss, or figuratively let die, pardon, or specifically divorce, let depart, dismiss, divorce, forgive, let go, loose, put, send away, release, set at liberty. A regular basket full of definitions that you want to pick, whatever you want to pick. Now, which one would we pick? Well, you're going to find this maybe a little bit strange, but it depends on what you want to prove. It depends on which view you want to take. Now, I want to show you how this bit about the definition works. And another thing that we take a stand upon, and that is concerning music. Concerning music. Now, what I'm doing here is I'm trying to digress a little bit to show you the same kind of logic that we use in one place that we're used to using, let's use it in another place. Concerning music in Ephesians 5:19, we have this verse, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody, solo. Again, I've tried to put the Greek word in English, solo, making melody in your heart to the Lord. But we don't have problems with that because here's the definition of that word. It means to twitch or twang, that is to play on a stringed instrument, celebrate the divine worship with music and accompanying odes, make melody, or simply to sing the psalms. Now, what is our position on music? Because of the way that word is used in that verse where it says, make melody in your heart, we take this part of the definition, sing psalms. And we say we sing where it says to sing in your heart. But the people that want to defend music in church use this exact same verse, this exact same definition, and they use this part, to twitch or to twang. So they're using the same verse we're using. They use the same Greek dictionary we're using. They're just picking a different part of the definition. Now, I'm not trying to convince you one way or another. I just want to lay all this out here for you, because this thing that we're studying, we'd like to say, well, everybody ought to believe like I do. But what if you run up against somebody that does it? And what if you run up against somebody that says, I've got an answer for every argument for married for life? I can answer every one of them and prove them wrong and scripturally prove why I should be able to remarry anybody I want to or whatever. And if you say, I don't think it's supposed to be that way, they're just going to laugh and walk off and do what they want to do. And if they are someone who is of no consequence to you, then, okay, just let them go do what they want to. But what if it's somebody you love? What if it's somebody you worried about their soul? You know, the Scriptures don't talk about adultery as being a light thing, even though in our society, fornication and adultery is no big deal. But to God, it still is. I've got to think it still is. He never told us He was going to slack up on it. Okay, so we talked about the definitions. Now, applying the exception. Let's get into practical experience. How have you ever seen the exception clause applied? What's your practice? I know what you say your theory is, but what's your practice? Okay? Here's one way. Unfaithfulness is claimed. The exception clause is enacted. One party is declared innocent, therefore free to remarry. Now, the party that's declared innocent is sometimes declared innocent by the elders of the congregation, by their family members, by others in the congregation, and whether it's right or wrong, oftentimes it's whichever person stays with the congregation. In other words, if there's a divorce and one person leaves the congregation and doesn't worship with them anymore, but if the other one stays there, then oftentimes it's whichever one stays with the congregation is the one that's justified, and they are the, quote, innocent person. Okay. We're going to get into this a little bit more tomorrow night. Brother, I don't really know how we think that because when a divorce happens, that one person in that union is automatically elevated to sainthood and that they are therefore innocent. We are all guilty. A marriage relationship is so dynamic that what one person does affects the other person, what the other person does affects one person, and I cannot see the consistent logic to say that there's one person that is of absolutely no fault, completely innocent. And that's the way that I've seen this used. Sometimes after a separation, for whatever reason, they just couldn't get along. After a separation, after a long period of time, one person finally begins to date, and then they get remarried, and then after that marriage, then, since it's assumed they consummated that marriage in a sexual way, then fornication outside of the first marriage was done. And so then the exception clause is enacted after there has been a remarriage. But see, the couple didn't separate because of that to start with. They just couldn't get along. And so what we do is we declare one party innocent that waited the other one out, that could hold themselves back longer than the one that decided that they were going to remarry. And so then that would enact the exception clause and make it okay for that congregation. Sometimes the elders listen, often to the innocent party, and then they enact the exception clause. I'm not making this one up. I'm not making any of these up. The fellow I worked with, his father was an elder in a congregation that had elders, and they believed in the exception. And he told me about times when the elders would get together and they would listen to a person as to whether they thought they had a just cause. Listen to one person. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? What kind of a story do you think they heard when they listened to one person? When they listened to one side of the story? Can you tell me if you've ever seen a coin that only had one side on it? I mean, let's just be brutally honest. Have you ever seen a coin with one side? Every coin's got two sides. Every story has got two sides. Let's be brutally honest, because we're talking about soul salvation here. We're not talking about just what I like and what you like, but we're talking about what is right. Okay, sometimes the elders listen to the innocent party and they enact the exception clause even before there was a divorce. I know of a specific case where the elders listened to a situation and told this person that, well, you just go ahead and divorce him if you want to. You're all right. You find somebody else, somebody here in the congregation or somewhere else. Told them before the divorce. There might have been a chance of working something out. The exception clause sometimes is enacted for reasons of financial support. And I threw this in here because when you go and you read after a lot of different people, I'm not going to hold anything back from you and paint you a rose-colored picture. I want to give you all the facts as I know it. There is a line of thought out there from the people that interpret the words that says the word interpreted adultery in the New Testament doesn't have anything to do with sex. What it has to do with is financial support. Financial support. It's about withholding financial support from a person. Doesn't have anything to do with unchastity or sexual immorality. So, just be careful who you read after. Because this one thing that I read, it went into a lot of detail, interpreting the words here and interpreting the words there to come up with the idea that it's financial support is the big thing, not immorality. Okay, so let's look at some points. And as I mentioned to you, I cannot give you all of the ones that I read about. But I am going to do this. I'm going to give you some from the Married for Life point of view. I'm going to give you some for the Married Until Fornication point of view. I'm not going to be like one of the preachers or the exception that I heard that got behind the pulpit and he said, well, this is the way the Bible says it to me. And he says, I just can't see that it can be any other way. Whenever someone's got a different opinion than mine, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to try to understand exactly what their opinion is. Because they may be right. Now, I'm going to believe I'm right until I'm proven wrong. But if I'm proven wrong, I'll change in a heartbeat. Because the truth's the only thing that's going to save me or anybody else. I cannot attempt to be saved if all I'm doing is backing up somebody else's position, because that's what most of the people in the congregation believe. So, if I'm proven wrong, I will change. And I don't fear standing here and giving you other people's point of view. Because I want you to know, you may have to answer this sometime. If things keep going, one of the congregations in this county may have to answer this question this summer. You never know when it's going to hit one of the congregations. Okay, a point for the exception. If Jesus said it, we should be able to do it. This is one of their points. Why Jesus said it, why would we even question whether that applies to us or not? Well, that sounds like a good point, doesn't it? I'll admit to you, that sounds like a good point. But let's use consistent logic now. I want to show you five little verses, and let's just see which one is consistent logic. I want to give you a counterpoint from the Married for Life point of view. Jesus said other things that we don't do. For instance, in Matthew 5:22, he said, "Whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire." Okay, look at the words that's highlighted. Shall be in danger of the council. Well, where's the council now? Well, there's not one. Somebody, if you're talking to one of these guys that believe in deception and they try to use this point on you and you use this verse and you say, where's the council? And they say, well, the council, that just applied back then. Okay, what did you just say? You just said, Jesus said something that applied back then, but that part of what he said doesn't apply now. Now admit, and I used this verse the other night, I believe in the principle that Jesus is giving here. I believe in the principle of not being angry without a cause, but not the practice of the counsel. That's an important point. Look at the next one. Matthew 5:23-24, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has aught against you, leave there your gift before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Where's the altar? Well, we don't have an altar. Okay, but they did then, so Jesus was speaking about something then. So what does that tell us? He was speaking about something then that doesn't apply to us today. In practice, but in principle it does. In principle, the principle, I believe, still stands, and I would preach this principle of reconciliation, but not the practice of the office. Luke 5:14, he charged him to tell no man, but go and show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing according as Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. Go show yourself. Would we attempt to follow this today? Would we get well and go show ourselves to a priest because Moses commanded it? Jesus said it. Why no? Do you get the picture? Consistent logic will bring up all these other things that Jesus said that we didn't bite on at face value. Luke 9:3, he said unto them, take nothing for your journey, neither staves nor scrip, neither bread, neither money, neither have two coats apiece. You could use almost the whole verse, but look at this. Nor scrip. Now, as I understand the definition, scrip meant the leather bag that they carried their things in. It meant their luggage. Okay, does that apply to us? If it does, when you went on your last trip, did you take a suitcase? If you did, you violated this. If we're going to take everything Jesus said at face value, we cannot take a trip and take luggage because Jesus said this. But we'd of course say, no, he was saying this at a special time in his ministry. Correct answer. That's the correct answer. Even when Jesus says something, to be consistent with the logic, we put it in the perspective that it was given. Okay, and here is the good one. Matthew 19:21. And before I read this one, let me tell you, one of the fellows that really, really contends for this exception has the idea that if he can ever find a law that Jesus gave that was not part of the Old Testament, but it was part of the New Testament, then that's his proof that Jesus could, anytime he wanted to, give a law that applied to the New Testament. And he wanted to really use the example of the rich young ruler. Because in Jesus' answer, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing about the rich young ruler, but in Jesus' answer, Jesus told him to go and sell all that you have. And so this is interpreted as a new law. And my position is, if you use consistent logic, that was not a new law, but that was simply a rephrasing of one of the Ten Commandments that said, you shall not covet. Because if you look closely at what Jesus had done, he had given 5 of the 6 commands between man and man in his reply just before he got to this verse. So Jesus wasn't giving a new law. He was simply rephrasing, thou shalt not covet, because that's the one he didn't give him before. If you'll study that passage closely, you'll see that. But, now, with that background, look at this. Jesus said unto him, if you will be perfect, go and sell that you have and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. Now, talk about being consistent. why in a person's right mind would they try to prove that this was a new law out of Jesus' mouth that we're supposed to follow? Go and sell all you have, your house, your car, clean out your checking account, sell your property, your cows, your clothes. That's what it says. And yet these people that believe this will say, we are not consistent. What if you could prove that this was the new law from Jesus? Brother, we'd all be bound for hell because I don't see a for sale sign in front of any of our houses or our cars. And our clothes aren't at the yard sale on sale every weekend, so we're all violating this one. So let's use consistent logic in whatever position we take. Let's don't use logic that's going to condemn us right off the bat. The point I want to make here is even the words of Jesus himself must be put into context in the time they were given and what they were intended to convey to us. Okay, another point for the exception. I gave them one. I'm going to give you the second one before we get over into the points for the married for life. A point for the exception. Those who forbid to marry are teaching the doctrine of the devil. One of the people that has written and compiled the most arguments against married for life and for the exception, assembled all these arguments. And if you read all these arguments, it'll almost overwhelm you and think, well, he's got to be on something. It's got to be right. But when you start looking at it point by point, you begin to see. This was one of his big points. This was one of the big points that if any person forbids anybody not to marry any person for any reason, they are breaking this commandment in 1 Timothy 4, verses 1 through 3. Now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from meats which God has created to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth. So here's the two phrases, the doctrine of the devil and forbidding to marry. Now I've always heard and been taught and been read, and I'll admit, I've been reading after Protestant commentaries that forbidding to marry was a reference years ago to the practices of the Catholic Church. Forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats was a prophecy of what that organization was going to enact. And now, here, some of those that want the exception now are going to take this passage and apply to any person, let me restate that, any person who would forbid anybody to marry anyone at any time. Okay, is that good logic? Now let's just think about that. Any person forbidding anyone to marry anybody. If a person forbids to marry, okay, let's just see in the New Testament who that would condemn as preaching the doctrine of the devil. Well, here's a counterpoint for married for life. Unless I miss my logic terribly, in Matthew 5:32 and 19:9, if you don't look at it only as trying to teach the exception, it teaches that you cannot marry certain people because it would be a crime or sin of adultery. Jesus, in that sense, forbade marriage. You can marry if you want to, but if you marry this person, you're going to be guilty of adultery, and she is too. Or whichever the case of the sex may be. But in giving the penalty of the sin of adultery, that is in a sense forbidding it. Unless we want to say adultery is nothing, they'll get married anyway, it is of no consequence. Which one of us want to take a chance on that? John condemned a marriage. Matthew 14:4, for John said unto him, this was Herod, it is not lawful for you to have her. Now, I didn't put a point in here for John the Baptist because I didn't have time and I was going to reference him right here. But here's something strong I want you to think about when you're putting this logic together. Why did John the Baptist die. He died because he told a person that he was married to somebody it was not lawful for him to be married to. Now I'm going to throw something out here because this is a situation that sometimes people try to say that the kingdom came when Jesus began to teach the kingdom. And so when Jesus was teaching, he was already teaching in the new kingdom, the new law. Well, if that was the case, and if it's as loose as these guys want to say it is, then John wouldn't have got killed for this, because he would have never told Herod that it was unlawful for him to have her. John messed up. John must not have known God's plan, because what John should have said was, would y'all just pray and repent? Or y'all just keep on doing this? It's all right. That really didn't matter anyway. But no, that's not what happened. Now think of this. The one that was sent to prepare the way for Jesus Christ, a person different from any person that ever lived or has ever been since, lost his life because he told a person his marriage was not lawful. And wouldn't that just be a little bit too cruel to think that God didn't give John the inside scoop on this new law stuff and let John lose his life for it? You know, if Jesus is over here preaching something entirely new that would have let Herod and his wife be okay, like it's practiced today, he would have been all right. There would have been a way for Herod to have been all right. Wouldn't it be cruel for God not to have told John that and let John open his mouth wrong and get his head cut off for it? See, I just don't think that's the way it was. I believe John knew what he was doing. He was doing it the way it was laid out. He was telling the law as the old law. It was not lawful. So from my way of thinking, John condemned this marriage. He would have forbidden this marriage if he could have been there before it happened. What about Paul? Paul forbade marriage, Romans 7:3. So then, if while her husband lives, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man. Now again, unless you think adultery is nothing, you've got to see that Paul's serious about this, and the person that does this is committing adultery, a sin. And in Revelations it said those that commit fornication and adultery, because of Jezebel's teaching, will be thrown into a bed, burned with fire, and their children killed. So I think it's still a serious thing. So in my way of thinking, the doctrine of devils, if a person is teaching the doctrine of the devil that says at any time a person cannot marry somebody else for whatever reason, you've got to put Jesus and John and Paul in there and say they're teaching the doctrine of devils too. And brother, to me, that is my definition of tortured logic. It sounds good, but when you put it to the actual test of what happened, it doesn't fit. So that's my counterpoint to that. Okay, here's a point for marriage for life. Remember the verse that says, "He put away. He that puts away his wife, except for the cause of fornication, cause her to commit adultery. He that marries her, that is put away." In that verse, there's two puts away. Matthew 5:32 and 19:9. Each one of them has the term put away twice. Okay? There is a point for married for life that says that the first put away connected the exception to the original law. Now, when I say original law, I'm going to refer back to Deuteronomy. And I'm going to put this out here for you so you can think about it. There's two passages on marriage in Deuteronomy. One is in Deuteronomy 22, one is in Deuteronomy 24. I'm saying Deuteronomy 22 is the original law. Deuteronomy 24 is the exception that was added because of the hardness of their heart. We're going to show you this in just a minute. Deuteronomy 22 says, verse 20 and 21, "But if this thing be true, and the tokens of virginity be not found in the damsel, then they shall bring out the damsel to the door of her father's house." Now get this now. They shall bring her out. Now in my line of work, we write contracts with people. We use the words should and shall differently. Should means you ought to. Shall means you've got to. It's the legal definition when you say shall. It says they shall bring out the damsel. They didn't have a choice. This was the law of the letter. And the letter said if these tokens of virginity aren't found, you shall bring the damsel out. to the door of her father's house, the men of the city shall stone her with stones that she die. They shall stone her. Because she has wrought folly in Israel to play the whore in her father's house, so shall you put evil away from among you. I believe that was the original law. It was intended. And the reason I say that is because if you read back in there, in that section of Deuteronomy, you're going to find about a half a dozen other things that are just this hard. A false witness, of course a murderer, and there are several other things that they said, you shall kill this person to remove evil from Israel. There were some hard things back then by the letter. Okay? So, this is the point for the marriage for life, that the first put away was Jesus trying to tie it back to the original Deuteronomy 22 law. Now, here's the counterpoint for the exception. I told you, I'm going to be honest about this. I'm going to give you every view that I can in the short time. I've got to get faster. Here's the counterpoint. Those who teach the first putting away is by stoning would have a man marrying a dead woman. Okay? They say this, and then they walk away. Hey, I got you. Yeah, I got you nailed to the wall. You can't answer this, can you? You're having somebody marry a dead woman. Let's look at the logic. I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, commits adultery. And whosoever marries her which is put away, stoned to death, does commit adultery. If the first put away meant stoned to death, then the second put away is supposed to mean stoned to death, so you're having somebody marry a dead woman. So that did away with that point. Well, now let's put it a counterpoint for the counterpoint. There are two cases of put away. When Jesus said, put away for the cause, except it be for the fornication, when he put in that exception, he branched the argument. He branched it into two separate things. Now you've got a woman, one case of fornication and one case whatever. Alright? If put away number two is meant to apply to both cases, then the exception is meaningless in the case of the woman, unless you think that it is meaningless for the case of the woman, it doesn't apply to her at all. If put away number two is for the woman in fornication, which is what their logic says, put away by stoning, then that just leaves those that were put away for whatever reason, they're just out there doing whatever they want to. They're not condemned for anything. If you say the second put away and try to tie that to stoning. But now let's look at something else. A parallel passage in Luke 16 and 18, Jesus said this, whosoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery. Whosoever marries her that is put away from her husband commits adultery. Now, in this verse, there's no mention of the exception, and we can see clearly that in this parallel passage, the second put away applies to the one that was put away for any cause. For any cause. That's what we understand the two points of the Jews were. You could put a person away for any cause, or it had to be because of the fornication. So, Luke 16 and 18, since it doesn't list the fornication clause, then it clears it up for us that the second put away was for the one that was divorced for any reason. If put away number two is for all others dismissed for any reason, then it cannot be used as a point against married for life. So, put consistent logic on it, and you'll see that the points don't match up. Alright, now, let's leave our points and counterpoints because we've got to move on quickly. Views for married for life. We started out with views for the exception. Now let's close with views for married for life. So, what is the context of Matthew 5:32 and 19:9? It was delivered when the old law was in effect. It was designed to restore the meaning to the old law. It was designed to introduce Jesus' principles, the principle of living by the Spirit and not by the letter. Now, I want to try to plant this thought that by the letter, that was the law of killing. That was the law of removing evil by killing the evil person. That was the law of the letter that they were under. Jesus is going to get us away from that and get us into the law of the Spirit, the law of cause and effect. Not just looking at the effect, but the cause of the effect. Jesus' reference to the exception was meant to tighten a loose marriage law. And I didn't have time to go into it, but in Matthew 19 and 9, up to the ninth verse, Jesus is addressing the allowance that Moses gave for the people to divorce their wife for whatever reason. Jesus says, because of the hardness of your heart. Deuteronomy 22 spoke of infidelity as causing people to be stoned. Well, a husband could accuse a wife of infidelity. She didn't like her. Have her stoned. And they were doing that apparently because they were hard-hearted. And so Jesus gave, Moses was allowed to give the exception. So now, let's look at Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 22 was the original law having to do with fornication and unvirginity. Deuteronomy 24 is when something just doesn't please one. When a man has taken a wife and married her, it comes to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her. Then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand. Send her out of his house. When she has departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. If the latter husband hates her and write her a bill of divorcement and gives it in her hand and sends her out of his house, she could be married to somebody else if she wanted to, but she couldn't go back to the first one. But the point is, here was Moses' allowance. In Matthew 19:9, Jesus had already said, Moses did it because your hearts were so hard, but from the beginning, and this is strong words, from the beginning it was not so. And my personal belief is that Jesus, in his teachings, was trying to get us to the point of perfection. He's trying to get us back to being able to do things the way things were intended from the beginning with His grace, His mercy, His forgiveness. All the things He's trying to teach us, He's trying to get us to the perfect way. And that's what I'm trying to teach to you. Views for married for life. I want to give you a little parallel example right here why what I think about the exception clause. It was given under the old law, and I believe it was tightened up from Deuteronomy 24 back to Deuteronomy 22. But does Deuteronomy 22 apply? I don't think so. Because of this. This has always stuck in my mind since I read it. The law by the letter. The law by the letter was nailed to the cross with the stoning of a rebellious son, and I believe the law of stoning of the fornicating partner. And I didn't mention this, but I've always wondered why, when they try to define the words in Greek, why did Jesus use a separate word for the fornication and adultery? It's separate words. It's not the same word. And some of the people that define them say it's the same. But that just sort of muddies the water. Again, it goes to which definition do you want. It depends on what you're trying to prove is which definition you want. But the facts are, in Greek, Jesus used two different words. From fornication to adultery. So what if Jesus was trying to refer to this original law of stoning the party guilty of the fornication and not as it's been transferred up to modern day times as meaning anything? Okay, the law of the letter was nailed to the cross with the stoning of a rebellious son, Deuteronomy 21. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them, then shall, no choice, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him, bring him out unto the elders of his city and unto the gate of his place, and they shall say unto the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard, and all of the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. So shall you put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. First verse we use, the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. The letter kills. The letter would kill for fornication. The letter would kill the rebellious son. The letter would kill about six other situations in civil law that they were commanded to live under. But now, what does Jesus look at? Instead of the rebellious son, he speaks to the father and says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, brethren. That's the cause. Jesus, when he changed from the law of the letter that killed to the spirit of the letter that brought life, he moved from looking at the effect to the cause. And Lord willing, tomorrow night we're going to talk about marriage by the Spirit, what was intended to be. The current law now, the one we're living under now, the law of liberty, the current law recognizes the interpersonal dynamics, cause and effect, of the marriage relationship, thus being a marriage by the Spirit. So, time's up. We've trudged through this thing tonight. I just wanted to give you some ideas because sooner or later, if you stay in this business long enough, you're going to have to answer some of these questions. And I just wanted to give you some of the things back and forth that will help you to get your logic straight, that you can stand on the answer you give, because it's going to be painful. Take my word for it. It's going to be painful for you to take this position sometime in your life. And you will not take it unless you fully believe that the Scriptures are behind you on this. Now, what I'm looking forward to, and I hope I haven't turned you off by some of this stuff that we needed to talk about tonight, but what I really look forward to is tomorrow night. Because marriage by the Spirit, that's our life, that's our living, that's our fun, that's the way it's supposed to be. This is what we need to get to, is marriage by the Spirit. So let's tie tonight up tomorrow night. If anyone's here, subject to the gospel call, to obey the gospel, through obedience to the gospel, through baptism, repentance, confession being added to the Lord's church, or the prayers of the church for strengthening or restoration, if you will let us, please come while we stand and sing. 100.